Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View with your host, PK, for Monday evening, May 28th. Boy, this month has gone fast. Got a little technical difficulties. There's storms in my part of the country today, and lost my internet briefly, and I think it's messed up my Skype, so I'm speaking on a landline, and you'll just have to make do, but my wisdom will still come through. So anyway, as I usually do, I will pay homage to the suits, the bosses, the cats in the office at bbsradio.com. Thank goodness for alternative media that supports free speech and free thought and free inquiry, because let's face it, free speech kind of has its back against the wall nowadays. They want to regulate the internet. They want to question our patriotism. Everybody's a suspected terrorist now as the security of the police state grows. And, you know, as like Ron Paul likes to say, the truth is treason in an empire of lies. Well, your host here, PK, is not intimidated by political correctness or trying to, you know, play on our patriotism, especially on today, Memorial Day, of which, of course, we give thanks to those veterans who pay the ultimate price in America's wars. And, you know, I get all that. However, that's where the story ends, because I move into foreign policy. And since I'm not on talk radio, I can't be shut down by the Rush Limbaugh crowd, the Hannitys, and their usual stupid accusations of, why do you hate America? Or, you know, this treasonous or unpatriotic, nonsensical accusations, which I, of course, reject. I don't buy into that crap. And in case you care to speak to me, the number here is 888-429-5471. In case the multitudes of listeners want to call in or challenge me or talk to me, this is where I am. So, and if since I'm on a different line, I'm not on Skype, I can still receive any messages from the office, so I'll be monitoring my, if they send me any little emails. And I'm here every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. So, on this special day, day after the Indianapolis 500, where that same fellow won again, I think it was his third time. It was Ashley Judd's husband. I think that's the Judd. Anyway, he won the race. And like I like to say about the Indianapolis 500 or the Daytona 500, any of these big kind of races, I always hope that nobody is injured or killed, of course. However, if they are, I hope the crash is absolutely spectacular, because if they're going to go out, they might as well go out in style, and it should be just fantastic with fire and, you know, parts of cars spewing everywhere and da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's an expensive rich man's game, and it's their sport, so, you know, that comes with the territory. So, again, I don't want anybody to see anybody hurt or killed, but if they are, let's make it spectacular, okay? So, having said that, yes, today's Memorial Day. Now, in my part of the country, there wasn't much, couldn't have been many outdoor barbecues, because it pissed down rain numerous times, cats and dogs. So, that's something I noticed, and I thought, well, gee, on this special day, they're going to have to move their grills elsewhere, I don't know, under the porch or somewhere, or maybe grill it inside, but they certainly weren't doing it with all this rain pissing down. So, anyway, as you remember, the fallen in America's wars, since I am a big fan and I embrace objective, intellectual, scholarly, revisionist history, I, especially in the last few years, I take issue with all these wars. Most of them were not even necessary. when you look back and you see what goes on. So let me say as a disclaimer, yes, 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 our troops fought valiantly and very bravely. That's a given. I understand all that. But I won't be intimidated by political correctness or, kissing up to the military to avoid the foreign policy that got them in the mess in the first place. So let's start with this century. The Spanish-American War, which started about 1898, was a completely unnecessary war. The politicians, McKinley, were intervening. They wanted to intervene with Spain over Cuba. Of course, Spain controlled Puerto Rico and Guam and the Philippines. So the federal government, in all their bluster and, you know, their big power trip, they send the battleship Maine down there to Havana Harbor. And soon after, it explodes, and I think it sinks. And what really happened was probably a fire or some kind of explosion in the boiler room or from the, you know, that sort of problem. And so, of course, it was convenient to blame Spain. Remember the Maine, as if Spain would have blown the ship up in that harbor to seek a war with the U.S. They used to call it the Needless War with Spain. So that's how the U.S. acquired Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, and then there was an insurgency in the Philippines. I guess nowadays they'd call the Filipinos who didn't want us their terrorists. So between McKinley and Roosevelt, they were responsible for the deaths of something like 200,000 Filipinos. So that's what their war with Spain got them. And in an empire, imperial sense, acquiring these other countries. And, of course, thinking the Filipinos were inferior and we had to look after them and all their interests and take care of that. So that became a mess. And again, an unnecessary war where a lot of people died. Too bad, in retrospect, Teddy Roosevelt, they didn't get him going up San Juan Hill because later on he caused the death of other people when he continued his imperialistic goal, sending the fleet around the country. And then he was a very big cheerleader for World War One later on. And then, I guess, luck would have it, or fair play would have it, his son is killed in World War One. I think he was a pilot. And old Teddy never got over that. But he ushered in that war. He was pro-war. He was, you know, like a Churchill of over here, you know, very pro-war. So that led America down the path to the Great War, the war to end all wars. World War One, which I am more of a student of and interested in, much more than World War Two. I might even know more about World War One than World War Two. But World War One was a crux of the issue, and it was a sort of a defining moment, and it pushed America more into imperial global democracy aims, fighting wars overseas with countries that did not attack the U.S. or threaten the U.S. So World War One, which was a horrific war, very scary, sort of like the Civil War on steroids, because you had all these trenches and this trench warfare, soldiers just locked in that for years, and just scary battles over the top for king and country, yeah. You know, I'd say kiss my ass nowadays to that. So, you know, marching into machine gun fire, ridiculous. You know, ridiculous things that went on, and the terror and the frightening, how scary it was, and, you know, running across those battlefields of barbed wire and mines and poison gas, and what a mess. And what you had was, what set it off in Europe was, they talk about the blank check that Germany gave Austria for its trouble with Serbia. They don't talk about the blank check that Russia gave to Serbia. So Germany is on the sidelines trying to wait till things cool down between its ally Austria and its, I think it was Serbia was ceding, or there was problems with the two in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So instead of Russia, you know, staying out of it and Germany, waiting till this intense climate blew over, they started to mobilize. So when France mobilized, Russia mobilized, Germany mobilized, and when France mobilized, Germany mobilized. And as I understand it, France was sort of the instigator in this whole thing. And here you have the Kaiser, the German king, or I guess top banana over there. His cousin is the Tsar of Russia. And his other cousins are on the English throne, Queen Victoria being his grandmother. And Germany was not interested in war with its neighbors. It was a very strong, rising industrial power, which Britain viewed with skepticism and envy and jealousy probably 20, 30 years before World War I. And Germany had also acquired some colonies in Africa, and I believe in China. And so they were resented by that. And, you know, imagine the nerve of massive imperial powers, Britain and France, with all their empires and all the cruelty and anything that went along with it, you know, them picking on Germany. Of course, then they plundered Germany's overseas colonies after World War I, and they took Germans' gold, and they, you know, basically bankrupted the country, destroyed the country. And Hitler's little miracle came later, but we wouldn't have had trouble with Hitler and all this other stuff had we not gotten involved in World War I, which sowed the seeds for communism and Nazi Germany and the whole deal. And what also happened, which I didn't know till about 6-7 years ago in my studies, is that the main reason the U.S. got brought in is because Britain realized it couldn't win without our help, and France. What you had was, you had Germany was allied with Turkey in the Middle East, and Germany built a big railroad from Germany into Turkey. And so those were the Axis powers. And Palestine was part of the Turkish Empire. So the German bankers, this is why where that saying comes, when Hitler said the Jews stabbed Germany in the back. Well, some Jews did. He's mainly referring, as I understand it, to the Jewish bankers, the Zionist bankers. And what happened was the Zionist Jews, the Rothschild-backed Zionist Jews, they wanted Palestine. They wanted a home for the Jews. And this was before World War II and the Holocaust. And to my knowledge, there was not that much persecution of Jews in Europe at that point. I know there was pogroms in Russia, but we're talking about Europe now. So the German bankers communicated with the British, and they said, look, because Germany was the master of Europe in 1916, they, for all practical purposes, they were the winners, and it should have been left that way. And then an armistice and a peace would have been had. So the German bankers, this is where the stabbing Germany in the back comes from. They go to the British and they say, look, you can still win this war. We'll bring the U.S. in on your side, but you've got to give us Palestine. There's where the Balfour Declaration comes from. So that's the deal they cut, and then they brought the U.S. into the war. And one of the ways they did that was because the British cut the telegraph cable lines from Europe to the U.S., but they didn't cut the ones from Britain to the U.S., so U.S. just got British propaganda and whatnot. There's also a story that President Wilson was blackmailed by a very prominent, well-to-do, powerful Jewish, lawyer, banker. I don't know if it was Bernard Baruch, but they had blackmailing letters, supposedly, that Wilson sent to a friend of his wife that he had an affair with from years ago, and so there was a bit of extortion going there and some intimidation, some hush money paid, supposedly like $40,000 to keep this person quiet, which Wilson didn't have that money, but someone else, one of this fellow that visited him, did it for him. So, as I understand it, so that's kind of what happened there. So then, you know, shortly after that, he brings the U.S. into war against Germany because Germany, the Lusitania, which which Germany published not to ride because it was carrying munitions, and so they staged and got us into this war, World War One, which they also he got a declaration of war for it. And a lot of people opposed it. A lot of people were thrown in jail, and you know, because they realized, I mean, even the socialists of the day realized that, you know, it's just the working, regular working class and poor people of one country being, you know, set against the ones in another country. So after this big mess of World War One is over, you had, you know, still a divided Europe. You had German territory taken away, given to Poland, Polish area, and the Czechoslovakia. And you know, so that was a powder keg, too, because millions of ethnic Germans did not want to live under, you know, a foreign government with newly drawn borders where, you know, millions or hundreds of thousands of Germans had lived for centuries under German rule. So, you know, which led to Hitler's attack on Poland and, of course, before that, taking back the Sudetenland, which was former German territory. That's why he marched into Czechoslovakia to make it sound like, you know, Hitler just came in there and took these things. But there was reasons why this stuff went down. And the climate during World War II, which had started in Europe, because Germany, I'm condensing everything, so I'm making my point about all these wars. Germany, Hitler got tired of what was happening in the former German territories in Poland. And there was also a dispute about the Danzig Corridor, where Germany wanted just a nice, powerful, wide road to get back and forth into this former German territory that was now part of Poland. And the Poles refused to negotiate and created a mess for Germany. So, and also, between the end of World War One and the beginning of World War Two, in the former German territories, the Poles kill over 60,000 German citizens, civilians. So Germany and Hitler was tired of that. So that's probably the main reason he attacked Poland, to get back those former territories and put an end to all this senseless killing of German civilians. Well, then that set off World War II, because Britain foolishly gave a guarantee to Poland, which got them nothing. It was something that they couldn't back anyway, because they didn't have as powerful an army as Hitler did. Part of the reason being that army was so powerful was because Hitler knew that he would have to stand up to Stalin someday, and also in case he was threatened or attacked by any other European countries, you know, namely France, Britain, you know, if this ever happened. So, you know, that all plays into it. And Roosevelt, FDR, was wanting to get the U.S. involved in the wars in Europe. But the U.S., wisely so, the majority of the people, they opposed getting involved in the war in Europe. Thank goodness for Charles Lindbergh and his America Firsters. You know, he said there's three groups of people that want us at war in Europe: the Roosevelt administration, the British, and the Jews. And he was right. So the back door into getting into World War II in Europe was in the Pacific, and Roosevelt maneuvered Japan into firing to make it look like they fired the first shot. So, and how did he do this? Well, during the late 30s, early 40s, Roosevelt cut off Japan's oil. There's an oil embargo on Japan. Cut off their raw materials. And then against the advice of his admirals, he moved the Pacific Fleet from California to Hawaii, which wasn't even a state, and it was actually taken in a violent overthrow about 1895 or so by American businessmen in league with the federal government. They overthrew a Hawaiian monarchy and basically took the place. I think it was a violent overthrow. So anyway, FDR moves the fleet out there. And they had already broken the Japanese code, and they knew that what they did to Japan with the embargoes and maneuvering Japan into that, making demands on it, diplomatic demands that were unacceptable to Japan. That was the straw that broke the camel's back and then caused the conflict. If they'd have told the truth, because they had broken the code, they knew that the attack was imminent. And they persecuted Admiral Kimmel, or was it General Kimmel, the two commanders at Pearl Harbor. They persecuted them and kept them silent. They court-martialed them, I believe, and blamed them for it when they were sort of kept out of the loop. And they weren't allowed to, when they testified, they weren't allowed, some of what they said as testimony was not allowed out, namely that they had already broken the Japanese code. So obviously during war they didn't want the Japs to know that we had broken their code. Meanwhile, these two guys were persecuted big time, but they were posthumously, I think, pardoned or awarded, you know, more medals or glory or whatever. So World War II was also staged. So when Japan attacked the U.S., what should have happened was, having known they broke the code and having known the attack was imminent, well, the U.S. Navy would have gone out to meet the Japanese Navy and they'd have had their day. But that didn't happen. So we had this protracted, expanded war. And so this, since Japan, Germany, and Italy were part of this tripart pact, whoever was attacked, their other two allies would come to their aid. So, and FDR, I'm sure, knew this. But hell, the bastard, he had already occupied Iceland and Greenland and was interfering with Germany. He sort of ordered American destroyers to shoot at German submarines and whatnot that were shadowing British convoys. But Roosevelt had no constitutional authority for this type of war making. So anyway, with this agreement between Italy, Germany, and Japan, this defense agreement, the tripart agreement, which was actually partially enacted to stand up to the Comintern, which is the communist threat. So shortly thereafter, after Pearl Harbor, Italy and Germany declare a war on the U.S. So Roosevelt and Churchill got their wish, a wider, bigger war. And, of course, the war profiteers, the war pigs, the military-industrial complex benefited handsomely off this. So, anyway, the tragedy, the whole awful war, and then the tragedy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so unnecessary. It's also said they did that to scare the Russians. So go ahead and kill a couple hundred thousand more people just to scare the Russians. Okay, so the tragedy and the mess of World War II ends in 1945. And then 5 years later, as the communist threat is growing, as I understand it, the Korean Peninsula was sort of divided, and there was some instigating from the south into the north and whatnot. So eventually, I've heard it, Stalin, it was Stalin who told North Koreans to attack. So anyway, Uncle Sam gets himself into another war, police action, as Truman calls it. So then this conflict starts from dubious means, and it goes on for 3 years, and about 50,000 guys are killed, U.S. soldiers, and probably a couple million Koreans, and all they did was fight over that 38th parallel, pretty much, and ever since then, it's been divided, and the North is a basket case, because it's stupid Marxist, Stalinist economy. In fact, if you've ever seen a picture of the Korean Peninsula at night, you can see the capitalistic South all lit up, and the North is almost black. It's actually comical how that those idiot dictators in North Korea keep their people so down and under their thumb after all those years. Those people don't have a clue about the outside world very much. It's probably going to change if they get the Internet or if their tightly knit society cannot control it. Their government, Marxist, communist government, if they can't control it anymore and the information seeps in, maybe they'll be overthrown. But I don't know. They got like a million-man army that's quite powerful. And it gets the you know, it gets the food and the attention. So that mess is just what it is. Marxism will fail on its own. And the U.S. and South Korea keep offering a carrot, you know, to North Korea if they won't use their, you know, will stop with the nukes and any testing of nuclear weapons, you know. And they try to scare us as if North Korea is going to get these missiles that could carry missile all the way to the U.S. Well, as if they wouldn't be shot down on the way. Yeah, there's dangerous countries, but I think that's been greatly exaggerated. Why would North Korea want to attack the U.S.? The U.S. can have submarines on the Korean coast and nuke it. I mean, why would they do that? I think it's nonsensical. They want weapons to you know, defend their own country, because when you have nukes, other countries won't bother you, even if they have nukes. And so, you know, Korea is not going to attack the U.S. They wouldn't even probably nuke South Vietnam because they know they'd face massive, brutal retaliation. I mean, they're tough, though. They're not something to be, you know, taken lightly, or they got to be reckoned with. But, you know, there's no need for war between the U.S. and Korea, North Korea. In fact, we should bring all our 37,000 troops home from Korea. You know, our troops are not welcome around the world. There's a lot of rapes on off military bases with the locals and the drunkenness and a lot of prostitutes. So, you know, it's not a good thing. And the sooner we bring all the troops home, the better. The country will be safer. They can spend their money at home. They won't be intervening and, you know, being like a tripwire for more war and just crap overseas. So, yes, which brings us to the question, you know, why are we still defending Korea? Our rich allies, South Korea, Japan, Western Europe, you know, Britain, why do we have thousands of troops stretched over there, as if the Constitution says we're supposed to be the superpower? Where do they get the constitutional authority for that? That's why I love to trip up conservatives and put them on the defensive, especially if they claim to be strict constitutionalists. Well, if you're a strict constitutionalist, please show me where the U.S. Constitution gives the federal government the authority to impose its military on the world and have a global empire. Yes, empire. And it's not necessarily the kind like the British Empire with forts everywhere. Yes, we have bases everywhere. But, you know, it's held together by all these bases. And it's like a $1 trillion foreign policy. And, you know, trying to police the world. It isn't necessary. It's not our national purpose. It's not constitutional. It's not part of the American ideals. But the neoconservatives, they're all for it. You know, the neocons, which have poisoned and heavily infiltrated the Republican Party. And so many Republicans sing that neocon line, the pro-war, pro-empire, you know, pro-military budget, bigger budgets, you know, and all that stuff's bankrupting the country, meanwhile. So, you know, how are you a world superpower with Russia and China? I mean, you know, they'll be coming up again, and they both have nukes. What, is Uncle Sam going to mess with his banker, China? Is he going to pick a fight with China that's got over a billion people and nuclear weapons? You know, so the ego of the American politicians and Uncle Sam is pretty amazing. I don't know where they get it from. So we're moving on from the Korean War, which is often called the Lost War, and we're going into the war in Vietnam. Get rid of those evil commies. So, I guess summer, fall of 1964, there's U.S. warships over off the Vietnamese coast. You know, their turf, their international water, their waters, and just the hypocrisy of the federal government. So, this whole Gulf of Tonkin situation, which has proved to be lies or fabrications or a facade, USS Maddox was down there, which was I believe it's a U.S. Destroyer. And prior to that, there was these South Vietnamese were running bandit raids into North Vietnam. They were testing and prodding and goading to see what, you know, the reaction would be. These little bandit raids and these, you know, little prick raids back and forth. So this annoyed the North Vietnamese. And I guess that they sent a boat out. I don't know if they shot any torpedoes at Maddox or U.S. ships, but who were in Japanese water, sorry, Vietnamese waters. But these small Vietnamese torpedo boats came out. I guess one may have attacked one of our ships or shot at it. I don't know that ever connected. I don't think anyone was ever hurt. And then I think it was the next day, supposedly, they said another torpedo boat came out towards the Maddox or another, you know, U.S. ship. Well, that was staged and fabricated also. So one thing led to another, and then that set off, that was their excuse, to get us involved in Vietnam. So that was the fall of 64. And by spring of 65, in March 65, good old LBJ sends U.S. troops ashore to Vietnam, as he would call it, to fight those evil commies. Well, I deplore communism, too, but this was a way to expand wars, expand the American empire, and feed that insatiable military-industrial complex, U.S. military-industrial complex, which probably did have something to do with Kennedy's demise, because Kennedy kind of pulled back and became more of a peace candidate, I believe, having served in the, you know, South Pacific and being in the Navy and hero of PT-109, you know, he saw war firsthand. So I think he backed away from it, and that's one of the reasons they whacked him. Also because he did not want to give nuclear weapons to Israel, didn't think they should have nuclear weapons. So then he moves to take troops home from Vietnam. That was some of his orders, or advisors and whatnot. Kennedy did, and this was in 63, I believe, because he had sent a lot of advisors over there, because they were helping the French who lost at Dien Phu Bu, still a French influence over there, and the U.S. was helping French planes refuel and this and that. So they supported France in its imperial war with North Vietnam. So you see how this all works out. There's always reasons for how things happen. So anyway, JFK, they whack him. The CIA kills him. I'm going to mention that a little bit more after this Jeff Johnson comment. So LBJ gets in power. Shortly after LBJ is in power, he reverses everything Kennedy does and expands the war, military-industrial complex. That idiot McNamara on his right-hand man, whatever, who was, I think, with Kennedy. But McNamara is another slimeball, and he escalates this stupid war, which was basically a civil war between Vietnamese and whatnot, instigated by the CIA, whatnot. I agree with Muhammad Ali, who refused to be drafted, and he said, no Vietnamese ever called me nigger. So he was right about that, and on a larger scale, the Vietnamese never attacked the U.S. The federal government instigated that war, and that led to the death of about 60,000 GIs and probably a couple million Vietnamese. A total waste, totally unnecessary. And I'm very pro-gun. I'm not a pacifist per se. I believe in, you know, defending yourself, your life, your property. Your life's your property, your country. But most of all, I don't want to fight for lies. I don't want to know that we were snuck into this under very dubious circumstances. That I don't like. I would never lie to our troops. I think it's ridiculous, and to the people. But that's what the military-industrial complex and the federal government and the state does. They're very powerful lobbyists, and regardless of who's in power, look, both sides support the war. The Wall Street Journal supports the war. CNN supported the war. You know, or they might try to act like they haven't now, but the Democratic leadership voted for the wars. So, and then Vietnam, you know, leads to this whole big mess, and then the collapse of the American influence in like March 75, Vietnam falls to the communists. But today it's trading more, it's trading with China, because Vietnam and China were at each other's throats. They were in late 79 and this and that, maybe 90, 91, because they were sort of like traditional enemies. Vietnam gave China quite a bloody nose in that little skirmish, a couple, you know, large-scale skirmishes between China and Vietnam. Okay, so the Vietnam War is over. They won the war, but we had better songs. So, moving on then, so that ends in about 1975. Then, by 19,
91, you have Desert Storm, how Bush protects us from those evil Muslims. Well, let's look at Desert Storm with when Saddam occupied Kuwait. Kuwait, by the way, which was formerly part of Iraq, and I think it broke away. And I'm all for secession, but this is just a sequence of events happening. I don't know that Kuwait seceding or leaving Iraq when it did. I think way prior to Saddam's leadership. I don't know how it was. Iraq had been under old British control. The British kind of carved it out. T.E. Lawrence helped, and they put a Saudi prince on the throne of Iraq. You know, and then he died, and one thing led to another. So a different dynasty of other leaders in Iraq, and then Saddam comes along. Well, and he gets pissed off about Kuwait and Saudi because they're tight. But you have, when he finds out that, you know, Kuwait was slant drilling into Iraqi territory for oil. So that was part of the problem. And also, as I've said before, with these stupid wars, you know, Iraq was much better off under Saddam. He kept a lid on the sectarian violence. Not nearly as many people died as what the U.S., the federal government, caused in Iraq. Saddam kept a lid on sectarian violence and war. He fought against fundamentalism, radical Muslim fundamentalism, for over 30 years. There was a small Jewish community in Iraq, probably more in Baghdad, small Christian community. Alcohol was tolerated. Iraq had the largest number of college-educated Arabs. So this idiot Bush comes in there, and he destroys the small Christian community, the small Jewish community. He causes the plight of millions of refugees. And this whole mess, which has cost us over $1 trillion, caused more hatred towards the U.S., so that has just made everything worse. And Iraq was not a threat to the U.S., to other countries. It never threatened the U.S. As you know, I always criticize Israel. Israel didn't care for Iraq because Saddam had the largest Arab army in the Middle East. Israel didn't like that. And, as you know, Israel has its boot on America's neck. I read a great quote from Thomas DiLorenzo last week, great Austrian school economist and author of The Real Lincoln. He said, I love this, why don't we just move the whole military-industrial complex and the Pentagon over to Israel? You know, they have so much power now as it is. Let's just move it all over there, the war machine. I love that. That'd be great. That's funny. So then George Bush gets his big balls going on, and he attacks Saddam, who wouldn't leave Kuwait, as if Saudi and Kuwait couldn't afford their own private armies with all their money. And Saudi and Kuwait, you know, they launched the oil embargo against us in 72, I believe it was. Of course, that was because the U.S. was supporting Israel back then also. So I see why Saudi and Kuwait did what they did. But so then we get Desert Storm. Wow, we beat a third world country. Wow, it made things worse. Then the federal government and its military deliberately destroys water treatment plants in Iraq, sewage treatment plants, power stations. So, you know, this nonsensical trouble has just made it worse. And then you have... So what is it? It's 91, and about then after 9/11, which I still believe that Osama bin Laden had next to nothing to do with, We have this idiot Bush who then decides that, well, they wanted to do this anyway. They wanted to invade Iraq, attack Iraq, which they talked about at their first cabinet meeting, which rather shocked. And that was in, like, I don't know, January, February 2001, and it rather shocked the new Treasury Secretary O'Neill. I don't know if it was Paul O'Neill, John O'Neill, but he resigned not too long afterwards, but he was rather shocked at the first Bush cabinet meeting, and like I said, in January or February 2001, when a large part of the topic was invading Iraq, hammering Iraq. You know, he's wondering what the hell's all that about. So then, when they got their little 9/11 issue, that really helped them, and that was part of the Project for New American Century, PNAC. One of its goals was that it said that short of another Pearl Harbor-like event, be hard to galvanize American public opinion against somebody and get the war going. So that is what started this whole thing going. And so Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, bears the brunt of all this. And Americans, so many stupid Americans, sheeple, still think that, I guess we attacked Iraq because they think Iraq was involved in 9/11. Yet Saddam fought against terrorism, like I said, like for 30 years. So then they started out bombing Afghanistan before they attacked Iraq. Now, Ron Paul voted for going into Afghanistan, but he didn't vote for going into war. He voted for, I believe it would be, letters of marque and reprisals, which is in the Constitution, where you would send out bounty hunters or assassins to get the bad guy or guys without bombing or hurting a whole country. This was not done. And I still think, again, that I think that Osama bin Laden had next to nothing to do with 9/11. Oh, by the way, I forgot to say hello to those pricks that are listening from the CIA and the FBI, National Security, all those pricks, Homeland Security, because they hate shows like mine. They hate what I have to say. They'd rather have me shut up and go away because they don't like the questions I ask. They don't like the history I espouse. They don't like my solutions. They don't like anything about me. You know, they would just as soon get rid of me and everybody else who has these type of shows because they don't want people to know about what's going on. However, nowadays, it's more difficult because with the advent of the Internet, you have a reversal of things because before the Internet, you know, like you talk about Big Brother, well, that's big government controlling people. There was a book out called, I think it's either Orwell's Revenge or Galileo's Revenge. And the concept is that 1984, Orwell was wrong in the sense that computers are spying on us for the government. It's sort of the opposite. Now, with the Internet, we know more what government's up to. And yes, there's a lot of BS on the Internet and untruths or half-truths, but you can still sift through it. It's harder for them to launch their false flag stuff or their, you know, their wars without a more informed public, because with the advent of the Internet, they just can't get away with a lot of the stuff that they used to get away with. And that's why they want to be able to shut it down, or in terms of their so-called national emergencies. So that's the kind of thing that they do. And, you know, we don't need any more war. The wars are bankrupting the country. Again, I'm very pro-gun, pro-gun rights, pro-gun ownership. And most of your typical anti-war lefties are, you know, anti-gun. Well, I'm not a lefty, never have been, couldn't be. It just makes no sense. And I'm a Ron Paul Republican. I'm not a regular Republican, big government rhino, corporate welfare, bailout, that mentality, pro-war, pro-empire, the neocon bastards like, I just can't stand that prick, William Kristol, guys like him, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, all these Kagan, all these neocon bastards who have infiltrated and taken over the Republican Party, basically, with their pro-war, pro-empire mentality and unquestioning support for Israel. But I repeat myself, because the neocon is pretty much the same. The pro-war is pro-Israeli crowd. And that's the problem. So move to today, and we're still fighting in Afghanistan. As I understand it, they wanted to put a pipeline through there. In fact, the Taliban, as I understand it, a few months before 9/11, they were in Texas. They went to visit Bush, and I guess they turned him down because he wanted to stick a pipeline through Afghanistan down to the sea to pump out that Caspian oil or whatever, because they want to kick China out or push Russia around. So, and I guess the Taliban refused his offer. So apparently he was stationing troops down there, getting ready to invade Afghanistan. And so 9/11 gave him a great pretext. But I don't believe those planes took the building down. I believe that they were yes, the planes hit the buildings, but they alone did not or could not take those buildings down. I mean, they were, the way they were imploded, and, you know, one right after the other, there was bombs going off downstairs. So I'm jumping around a lot here from about war and this and that. I'm going to the 9/11. Of course, 9/11 has set off more war, the global war against Islam. That's the new bugaboo, because the evil communists are gone now. So what do we have left? We have those evil Muslims. Meanwhile, the U.S., as I like to say, before 1948, when Israel was violently imposed upon Palestine, before then, the U.S. had no enemies in the Middle East. And ever since it started backing Israel, and that Truman recognized Israel against the advice of some generals and important people, idiot Truman went ahead and recognized Israel, partly because he received about $2 million in his 1948 election campaign money from wealthy Jewish donors. So Truman goes ahead and recognizes Israel. So that was the start of the problem. And ever since then, the U.S. supported Israel and held its hands, given it, you know, endless supply of free American-made murder weapons and foreign aid, you know, as if the American taxpayer is required in the Constitution to give Israel an endless supply of foreign aid and an endless supply of free American-made murder weapons. Yes, I'm very critical of Israel's Zionism and Jewish power. And it plays a big role today, more than you would ever think. Jewish power, Israeli power, they're the Israeli lobby and AIPAC, which I, of course, have renamed the American-Israeli Parasites Against the Constitution, pushing for more war. But meanwhile, as I understand it, you know, the rank-and-file Israeli population doesn't want war with Iran. You know, Iran knows that Israel has all these weapons, and Iran knows that it would be, you know, crushed, crystallized in an exchange. But even if Iran did have a nuke, then Israel's not going to mess with it. You know, other countries aren't going to mess with it that much. So, you know, this is a big problem. Meanwhile, Israel has 200 to 300 nukes, which they will not acknowledge. You know, their stupid Samson plan, where if they go down, they're going to take other countries with them. They have missiles pointed at probably Rome, London, Paris. They're very capable of hitting those countries. I wish Germany would stop giving Israel free nuclear subs. You know, the Germans give them out of their guilt trip. They're giving these damn Israelis this so much still. And then you have the Holocaust industry, like Norman Finkelstein writes about with, all these Jewish survivors of the so-called Holocaust, the whole industry of the Holocaust industry. So you have that, you know, in there, too. It's a real mess. But I've pinpointed it pretty well, and I don't back down from it. I have these discussions all the time. But keeping in mind, as critical as I am of Israel and Zionist power and Jewish power, I'm not a hater. It's not connected to hate. It's not connected to so Israel did this, so we ought to kill the bastards. No. No, it's not what it's about. It's always an expose on power, regardless of who yields it, or actually regardless of who wields it and who yields it. Mine is a constant expose on power. And if toes get stepped on or commonly held sacred cows are threatened, so be it, because I won't back down, and I won't back down. This is my great singing. So anyway, as we celebrate Memorial Day, again, our fallen, they served, they fought bravely and valiantly, but most of the time they fought for lies and trumped-up reasons and to get all these nations of millions against millions, so many getting so many killed and maimed for life, and the destruction of property and homes and lives and families and careers. And meanwhile, in the U.S. military, suicides are at an all-time high, as is spousal abuse, as is military divorce. So these idiot neocons, well, they're all rich, the journalists and the bashers they are, they're, you know, and the Zionist crowd that they are, you know, they're not going to go to the front lines. They're not going to go and carry a gun and get their asses killed or their family members killed and have to deal with all that. They retire as rich journalists, the bastards, you know, banging the drum for war and then getting these other people killed because of their stupid policies and outlooks and their worship of Israel. So, and with that, I'm going to end my little chat about war and Memorial Day because I've come to the end of my show. And I am ending it now and letting the suits know so they will bring me off. And I can play my taking it to the streets, as they are doing in Syria. But a lot of this stuff is staged, and there's Mossad agents and stirring up trouble and CIA. So, you know, who knows who's doing what? It's best to have a non-interventionist policy of armed neutrality. So, and with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to give my wisdom a rest till next week. And this is your host, PK. I am here every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern, as I bring forth my hard-hitting critiques and solutions for socio-economic problems as only as I can, with no fear of censorship or political correctness or the usual cowardly accusations of racism and anti-Semitism. Nope, I reject all that nonsense. So here I am on BBSRadio.com, Station 2, Mondays, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. And with that, I bid you farewell and good night. Till next week. Happy Memorial Day.